Again, let me mention here, introduce our guest for the first part of the show, Justin Martin. He's a former staff writer at Fortune magazine. His work has appeared also in Newsweek, Worth, Travel and Leisure, and ESPN. And his book, Alan Greenspan, The Man Behind the Money, is published by Perseus Publishing and is just out. Questions, of course, are welcome. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Martin, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very, very much, by the way, for being so patient with our changes of schedule here. I'm real pleased that you could talk with us.
Oh, no problem at all.
Here's maybe one way to begin this. Here in Alan Greenspan, we have an individual who is, first of all, he's head of the Federal Reserve, which is a body that I think probably most people don't really understand. I include myself in being a little unsure about what the Fed does, and at some point we'll talk about that. He's an economist, which for a lot of people is an impenetrable science. He is not personally a particularly flamboyant individual, not someone that you read much about outside of his role as Fed chair.
Mm-hmm.
And having said all of that, people are fascinated with the man, and that he, when you have things like, you know, rankings of America's most interesting people, he's on those lists along with athletes and show business people and, you know, other more prominent politicians. And you really wonder why, what is it about him that fascinates people so much?
Well, let's see. That's a great question. I guess I'd say a couple of things. First of all, here is a great example where a person is matched with a job that they're able to do very well, and it just so happens that being Fed chairman requires a cautious, impartial, judicious economist, and Fed chairman, obviously, with so many people in America invested in the stock market, has become a much more important job. It's become a very important role. So I guess first and foremost, I'd say in a society in which people are often mismatched with whether it be in government or politics or business or what have you, here you've got someone who's perfectly matched to do their job. I guess the second thing that makes Greenspan particularly compelling or interesting to people is his job literally requires him to be discreet and to sort of provide double speak and circumlocution, and so he is very mysterious, and the workings of the Fed are very mysterious, and what he says, just every so often does he provide a soundbite, like the famous irrational exuberance comment of 1996, and people are all over that because it's a clue or a hint. I guess finally people sense, and I learned in the course of writing and researching my book, that there's more to this man, and he does in fact have a fascinating history as a professional jazz musician when he was a young man, his time with Ayn Rand. So people perceive there's something sort of still waters run deep, and there's quite a story there.
Yeah, we'll get into some of those things, but I guess as a general point, it sounds as if you're saying that there is much more to him than we see as he plays out his public role on the public stage. That is, what you see is really not all of who this guy is.
Very true. In fact, I guess I'd say two things. First of all, I guess what the Fed in fact does, its actual doings and dealings are very arcane, and so it's difficult, even for professional economists, it's difficult to sort of make sense of that. But what makes Greenspan particularly fascinating, I guess, is he actually practices part of what the Fed has to be able to do is to surprise the markets. The markets are always trying to anticipate which direction interest rates are going. If the markets were able to completely anticipate what was going to happen, it might actually be create a difficult situation in which the Fed was no longer could use its tools to surprise. And so it's important when Greenspan speaks in public that he actually double talk, and he actually practices this and has practiced it for many years. And I talked to several people that work with him at the Fed who said he'll actually sit down before he appears before Congress and figure out ways to make something that would normally be two or three sentences draw it out over many sentences so that he can kind of keep that veil of secrecy in place.
Hmm. He was born in New York during the Depression, and one would have to imagine that if anything would be a powerful force in shaping one's thinking about the economy and economics, having experienced the Depression and he certainly was not somebody who was born into great wealth. How did his upbringing, his childhood, you think, shape him?
Well, most certainly the Depression was a defining event, particularly because historians in retrospect have determined that one of the major mistakes made that created the onset of the Great Depression was actually poor policy by the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve actually tightened the money supply at a time it should have loosened the money supply. And so Greenspan, I guess you could say first and foremost, when he became Fed chairman, he was well aware that some of the childhood poverty he experienced was a direct result of the institution he was now heading up. So as Fed chairman, he had his first big test in 1987 when the market crashed, and he did exactly the opposite, loosened up the money supply following that crash, did exactly the opposite from what the Fed did in 1929 that really caused the Depression to be deeper and more intractable than it otherwise would have been. So I'd say that's sort of the first thing. The second thing about his youth and upbringing that's intriguing to me is, you know, his father, although he abandoned the family, was a professional economist, and so that certainly left Greenspan, you know, in his childhood with a gift for economics. And the family he grew up with after his father abandoned the family was a very musical family, and that also left Greenspan with some certain gifts. So Greenspan became a talented musician, and he, as an adult, as Fed chairman, has shown a great ability to improvise.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting that he, given the circumstances of his childhood, went on to become an economist because perhaps in some part because his father was. You would imagine that some people in circumstances like that would decide that the last thing that they would want to be was an economist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, the way that I look at it, kind of, it's almost as if you know, maybe this is evidence that genetics play a major role or something, because his father abandoned the family. His father, who was a professional economist, abandoned the family when Greenspan was 5 years old and really played very little part in Greenspan's life from that point onward. And Greenspan was raised in a very musical family. His grandfather was a cantor at a synagogue in the Bronx. His cousin Claire went on to sing in the original Broadway production of Annie Get Your Gun alongside Ethel Merman. So he grew up in this very musical family, and Greenspan himself took up the clarinet, became a very practiced and accomplished musician. And yet, it seems to me he also had great math skills. As a young boy, he was able to actually add up three-digit numbers in his head, and his mother would trot him out in front of guests. It was sort of an odd thing. Here is this musical family, and yet this child has these math skills, which are probably maybe the genetic bequest of his father. And so Greenspan found himself drawn to math and to economics, even though he was raised in this very musical family.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I guess also there are some people who would be prepared to make the argument that music is, in fact, a very mathematical art, and that it's not all that unusual that those two things would come together in a person.
That's a very good point. In fact, Greenspan himself has said that he's a big fan of the composer Haydn, and he said that listening to a Haydn composition to him is very similar to working out complicated economic or math problems. He likes to watch the notes as they are sort of travel towards a satisfying conclusion, the same way when one looks at a data series, they want it to add up neatly to some kind of conclusion.
Hmm. The other sort of interesting part of this is his interest in music, the fact that he did actually play professionally. He was in a jazz orchestra that toured all over the eastern part of the United States, and he made some money, not a great deal of money, although I don't know. He made something like $60 a week at that time.
That's right. Uh-huh.
Maybe that wasn't so bad for doing something that you really wanted to do. Did he at some point think about really making, over the long term, making his living that way?
You better believe he did. In fact, when he was in high school, he was just enwrapped in music. I mean, he played in the high school orchestra. He played in an amateur swing band, or sort of semi-amateur swing band, that toured around the neighborhood where he was growing up, and played at temples and church dances on Saturday nights for $2 per band member per performance. And as a young man, he also took music lessons alongside of Stan Getz, who, of course, went on to be a great jazz musician and among other pieces, composed The Girl from Ipanema. And Greenspan, in fact, as a young man, when he was hanging out with Stan Getz and playing in his orchestra, always said he wanted to be the next Benny Goodman. That was his ambition. Benny Goodman was a huge star at that point, you know, the equivalent of Elvis or the Beatles later. And Greenspan really emulated, or wanted to be able to emulate, Benny Goodman. And so when Greenspan went out and joined this jazz band, he really wanted to be a professional musician. He wanted to make a career out of this. But in the course of playing in the band, although Greenspan was a competent professional, he was also forced to stack himself up against people who were far, far more talented than he was, such as Al Cohn. And Greenspan ultimately saw that music might not be the right route to take.
Mm-hmm. He did. So then how is it that he made the decision then to go on to graduate school and to take that path?
What's very interesting, he literally, when he was in the band, he was in the he was in the saxophone section, and so he was called upon to sort of you know, make the little beeping noises in the background while someone like Al Cohn might be called upon, or Johnny Mandel, who was also in the band, Johnny Mandel, who later composed The Shadow of Your Smile and the theme from MASH. So these are very talented musicians. The band that Greenspan played in was called Henry Jerome and His Orchestra, and they were sort of a second rate. They were certainly no Benny Goodman. They were not Artie Shaw. They were not Tommy Dorsey. They were kind of a second rate act. They toured around. They certainly got gigs, and they recorded albums, you know, nothing that was a major hit. But even within this band, there were some very, very talented musicians who would later go on to really make names for themselves, such as Al Cohn and Johnny Mandel. And Greenspan really was forced to stack himself up against these guys while playing in the sax section and realized he just didn't have it. In the meantime, he was really getting drawn to the topic of economics. And during the band's set breaks, they'd have half an hour set breaks in between, you know, half an hour performances, and he would spend that time reading economics textbooks. He found the topic gripped him. He found he had an aptitude for it, and so he decided to drop out of the band and enroll at NYU.
And one other sort of little irony, given who he is now, he had to drop out of graduate school because he was having a hard time coming up with the money to pay the tuition.
That is correct, yes. He, while he was in graduate school, he also got married briefly back in the 1950s. He was just married for 10 months, and so with a new wife and with the cost of graduate school, Greenspan was felt at that point that it just didn't look like the right route to be taking. He's also always, I should point out, been kind of an innate pragmatist, and he was just as he was really itching to get out and play in the jazz band, he was really itching to get out and sort of practice as an economist, and so the idea of being in grad school for many years pursuing a PhD began to look less and less attractive once he had a new wife and the prospect of a long term in grad school.
I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. Justin Martin is former staff writer at Fortune magazine, and he is the author of a newly published biography of Alan Greenspan, head of the Federal Reserve. The title of the book is Greenspan, The Man Behind the Money, published by Perseus Books, if you're interested in looking at it. And, of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere. You can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And if you match the numbers with the letters on the phone, you get WILL. So 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. We do have a couple of callers here. Why don't we go to these folks and see what questions they'd like to ask. We'll start out with a caller in Champaign, and this will be line number one.
Yeah, actually, this doesn't have anything to do with Alan Greenspan. Stan Getz didn't compose The Girl from Ipanema. Sorry. I'm a big fan of Stan, but I won't give him credit for that. It was Antonio Carlos Jobim.
Fair enough. Good point. I appreciate the correction. I guess Stan Getz recorded
Stan Getz recorded the most famous version of it, but he wasn't
actually Jobim, right? So
he didn't write a whole lot. I think he mostly did other people's. He arranged other people's stuff. But anyway, thanks.
Oh, I appreciate the point of clarification. Thanks.
Well, you got to be careful what you say, I guess. There's always somebody out there who's going to be a fact checker. Okay. Well, let's go to Freeport then. Line number four. Hello.
Person who was Federal Reserve Chairman before Greenspan?
Before Greenspan, it was a person named Paul Volcker, and he was a two-term Fed chairman, just as Greenspan's now a four-term Fed chairman, and was
concerned. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, my comment is that since the Reagan administration, at least I believe before that, the Federal Reserve Chairman, which is a key economic position, sort of an economic czar over the U.S. economy, they've been Jews. You know that? And I'd like to know why this is. It shows the power of the Jews over the U.S. economy.
Wait. I just want to make sure where you're coming from. Are you suggesting that somehow Jews dominate the American economy?
They sure do.
Oh, man, you are really a warped individual. I'm sorry. I think we're maybe done with that guy. I don't know. You want to make some kind of response to that, Mr. Martin?
It's not worth responding, except I'll respond in just the simplest manner by saying that if you look at the one of the most esteemed Fed chairmen ever, that would be Mariner Eccles, a Mormon. You could then look at another very esteemed one, William McChesney Martin, who is not Jewish. So it was an irrelevant question, but just to give people a little historical perspective, there have been, I think, 13 Fed chairmen, and they've been a mix of ethnicity and background.
Now, how long now has Mr. Greenspan been head of the Fed?
He's been head of the Fed now for 13 years.
And how is that longer than any other individual held that?
Interestingly enough, it's not. Actually, William McChesney Martin, who I just mentioned, was a five-term, if I recall right. He served for 19 years in total, and he served through five different presidencies, starting with Truman and all the way up through Nixon. So he had the longest tenure at this point.
And when does now his term, when would he come up for being reappointed?
Well, interestingly enough, he'll come up for reappointment in January of 2003, which guarantees that our next president, whoever it might be, looks like it may well be Bush, but whoever it will be will get a chance to either renominate Greenspan or pick a new Fed chairman. Mm.
Well, I know back during the primaries, John McCain, for example, said that if he was the nominee, if he was elected president, he would ask Mr. Greenspan to continue. It seems likely that anybody, whoever the next president would be very likely to ask Mr. Greenspan to continue. What sort of thinking is there about whether or not he would want to do that, whether he'd want to continue to be chairman of the Fed?
Well, the thinking is that he obviously is very loves the job, is very good at it. When I spoke to his wife, Andrea Mitchell, for the book, she told me that even here in his fourth term as Fed chairman, when, you know, in a fourth term for many other political figures in Washington, they would almost be lame ducks, Greenspan continues to get up at 5:30 or 6 every single morning, including Saturdays and Sundays, and get right down to work. He takes his role very seriously, and he also has a real passion for economics and Fed policy. So it looks, and I guess the other thing that should be pointed out with Greenspan is, unlike some people of the age of 74, two things. One, he's in very good health, continues to play tennis almost daily and eats very well. And two, unlike a lot of 74-year-olds, he doesn't have any children or grandchildren. And so I think that there's not so much else to occupy his time. He loves the job. And so if he's, it's likely that if the president wants to reappoint him, he'd be likely to agree to that.
Mm-hmm. We have several other people here in line now to talk. Let's do that. We'll start in with Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I had a question about Greenspan's connection to Ayn Rand, and I was interested in hearing more about his relationship with Ayn Rand, and I'm also interested in knowing why people don't make more of that. I guess maybe they think he's left his youthful indiscretions behind, but I was just interested in hearing more about
that
relationship.
Great question. Mm-hmm. Greenspan, people may not know this, but he had a very, very close association with Ayn Rand. He sort of joined, it was a group called The Collective, was the name that they kind of gave themselves, and they would meet on Saturday nights at Ayn Rand's apartment in New York City and talk deep into the night about politics and philosophy and music and economics. And Greenspan joined this group in 1953, and he was a regular participant at these Saturday night sessions all the way up until 1968, and very close with Ayn Rand. He helped her do research for her magnum opus, Atlas Shrugged, helped her do research on the railroad industry, which was figured large in that book. When Atlas Shrugged received a scathing review from the New York Times, Greenspan wrote an angry letter that was published in the New York Times in the fall of 1957. Greenspan wrote essays supporting Ayn Rand's particular views about laissez-faire economics. He wrote essays for her newsletters, one of her newsletters called The Objectivist. He played on the Objectivist softball team that Ayn Rand, Ayn Rand's followers formed a couple of softball teams that played against one another called the Witch Doctors and the Huns. Greenspan played first base for the Witch Doctors. He on and on and on, basically. He gave a lecture called it was a lecture on a free economy or on laissez-faire economics that he delivered at various Ayn Rand sponsored events. So he was very, very involved in them. So that's sort of the first answer, the answer to the first part of your question. Then it's very intriguing that people have disassociated himself in a way from Ayn Rand. I'd say that's for two reasons. One reason is because Greenspan himself has always been very, very good at deflecting his critics. And when people have questioned, he's never really, he's never gotten his hackles up or had a defensive response. He simply said that Ayn Rand helped him to really see a moral component of capitalism that he's always appreciated. So first of all, sort of the neutral and undefensive response he's had to critics has kept people from looking more closely. The second thing is Greenspan is a master at the flip-flop. Here's a man who, when he was in Ayn Rand's inner circle, wrote essays criticizing the meddling of the Federal Reserve, and now he's chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. Throughout his career, here's a former musician who became an economist. Here's a person who, when he was first exposed to economics, was interested in Keynesian economics, which is sort of the more liberal strain of economics that Franklin Roosevelt took up in the depths of the Great Depression, and then he did a flip-flop during grad school to become more of a conservative economist. So he's a person capable of great flip-flops, and so I think another issue is Greenspan as Federal Reserve Chairman is fundamentally a different person than Greenspan as a member of Ayn Rand's inner circle, and I think that people rightly recognize that and think not so much that it was a youthful indiscretion, but it was just another stage in a long and varied career.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. From what little I know about Ayn Rand and her thinking, I think it's fair to say that her philosophy was extremely conservative, for one thing, and that it elevates individualism, individual effort, with this sort of concentration on the heroic person who strikes out on his own, going up against traditions and conventional wisdom, and that achievement is all about these few heroic path-breaking, rule-breaking kind of individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see any of that reflected in Greenspan's economic philosophy, or his policy, or anywhere where you see hints of that, or shadows of that in his real day-to-day activities as Fed chair?
I would say in one major way, and I was when I spoke with his wife, and she said to me that he feels this immense responsibility for the role that he plays and with how seriously he takes his job. I was struck by the Randian notion that those who are blessed with great talent must in turn take great responsibility. And I felt like perhaps at least in one way that was a reflection, the fact that as Fed chairman he recognizes that he has a complicated arcane job that many people wouldn't be well suited for, and that it plays a major role in the health of the economy, and he takes it very seriously. I was struck by that having kind of a Randian echo. But then I should also point out, contrary to all of this, I mean, and it's important to make this distinction as well, at the same time, the Federal Reserve is an institution of government that meddles in the economy, which was something that Ayn Rand and her inner circle were very critical of. And in fact, as I pointed out earlier, Greenspan actually wrote an essay published in a 1966 issue of Ayn Rand's newsletter, The Objectivist, in which he took his future employer, the Federal Reserve, to task for lack of independence. So while there may be some strains or echoes of Randian beliefs in the way he comports himself, he's also heading up an institution which Rand and her followers never had an easy time with.
Other callers. Let's go next to another Champagne person. This is line number two.
Hi.
Hello.
To kind of help me understand the working of a Fed chairman and with what you were talking about with Ayn Rand and the independence of the Fed, who does he actually have to answer to? I know he's a political appointee, but he has a very long appointment. And once he is appointed, what kind of political pressures are there on him from either side? I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, thank you. Great question. I'll say, first of all, that there's intense pressure on the Fed chairman from the executive branch. The president of the United States would at any given time love to see interest rates fall. Any president at any moment, no matter where interest rates are, would love to see them lower. particularly come re-election time, it's the dream of any president that interest rates might be down around 2%, that the interest rates the Fed sets might be down around 2% come election time, because there'd be all kinds of new mortgage generation, and there would be, the economy would boom, and then maybe later it would be a disaster, but at least the president would be re-elected. So there's this constant tension that the executive exerts on the Fed chairman. They may, in bad cases or dysfunctional cases, such as George Bush Sr. and Greenspan, who really had the poorest relationship of any Fed chairman and president probably in history, George Bush Sr. would periodically during States of the Union say interest rates must be lower now, which was an obvious sort of direct attack on the Fed's policies. Also, the Treasury Secretary and the Fed Chairman have a tradition of having a weekly breakfast, and at that breakfast there's a lot of communication and information exchange, and that's a prime opportunity when the Treasury Secretary sits down with the Fed Chairman for the Treasury Secretary to say, hey, listen, we feel, the administration, that interest rate policy is out of whack, interest rates should be lower, that kind of thing. So a whole lot of pressure from the President, from the Executive, towards the Fed Chairman at almost any given point to lower interest rates. The Fed chairman is called upon to look at the data, weigh the data, and make decisions that are more impartial than that. But one way of looking at it might almost be, it's almost like the Supreme Court in a way, where a Fed chairman is nominated by a president and then has to follow different dictates or mandates in order to do the job effectively, supposedly, the mandates in this case of the Fed, in the case of the Supreme Court justice of the Supreme Court, versus trying to curry the favor of the person who put them there in the first place.
Mm. Of course, Supreme Court justices are appointed for life. Fed chair is not appointed for life, but for
a fixed
period of time. But if, for example, during the term of the Fed chair, if he did something that enraged the president, enraged the Congress, enraged the country, is there anything anybody could do about it? Is that individual safe for his term?
They're safe for their term, provided they don't engage in any kind of criminal malfeasance. And with that in mind, that's a very interesting question you raised, because up until Greenspan, Fed chairmen have never been in such high-profile roles. It would be very interesting. I mean, from a statutory standpoint, the only way a Fed chairman could be removed is if they did some kind of criminal misdealing. But we've also never had a point in history in which, maybe the economy slides into shambles, and now with the Fed chairman a much higher visibility role, it'd be interesting to see what Congress and the president did if sort of all eyes were turned on the Fed chairman.
Yeah. Let's go to Champaign County next, line number 3. Hello?
Yeah, I have a number of points, but the last interchange elicits from me the fact that you didn't even mention the Humphrey Hawkins sort of interviews with the Congress.
Good point.
And that's because they've become not so much a way of talking to the Congress or getting any pressure from the Congress or getting advice from the Congress. It's basically a periodic time for the Fed chairman to deliver a message to the markets, who are his real constituency. And what you have to be a Fed chairman is to worship fortune, basically, money, capital. And that's why William Grider's book on the Fed is called Secrets of the Temple.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another book, Martin Meyer's book, that produces at the end the cover letter that Greenspan wrote, giving his blessing to the biggest single savings and loan takeover. I'm forgetting the names right now.
Yeah, it was Keating's savings and loan, which was called Lincoln's savings and loan.
The book is called The Greatest Bank Robbery Ever, and it's about the SNL, and it includes this section on Greenspan's role when he was out of public life. He was in charge of an accounting firm, basically, and they gave a great no structural problems here to the Keating thing, which then collapsed and was the biggest single. He also, I think Meyer, when he was on this call-in show, actually pointed out that Greenspan, also when he was in, before his being appointed to the Fed, was in charge of a mutual fund that got absorbed, which is the same thing as going bankrupt, basically. So you're calling him judicious and careful economist is belied by some of the facts that aren't very much mentioned. In the latest Vanity Fair, which I don't suggest people buy because there are too many bloody ads in it, but there's an article by Christopher Hitchens about, and includes some of the stuff about this economic acumen of Alan Greenspan, at least when he was in private life. It seems to me, and I won't have time to develop this role, there are other people that have written books about the Fed, and I think that maybe Grider would be a good one to have back. I think the other one by the Washington Post, Woodward, is pretty much a paying to his acumen as well. But the stuff that Hitchens has on him is pretty good. It has some stuff about the personalities in the Ayn Rand thing. As an Ayn Rander, I guess you might say that he's the best person to be there in the Fed because he can sort of do what he can to contradict, to counteract the governmental system, and I think that's probably the calculations he's made. Another calculation he may have made is since he's pretty much charged with losing Bush Sr.'s presidency by sequentially raising the interest rate, he's sort of done the same in the end of this four-year term as well. As you notice, I disagree with you on premise and fundamentals, but I don't have much more time to go into colloquy with you, so I'll just let that hang out in the air. And
all right, well, let's
do a do.
The caller makes a number of points. You can respond to any of them that you like.
Sure, I'll be happy to. It's simple enough to respond to it. First of all, on the issue of criticism of Greenspan, anybody who reads my book will see there's plenty of criticism where criticism is due. I certainly mentioned discussed the letter written about the savings and loan debacle and the mistakes Greenspan made there. Hitchens' article in Vanity Fair actually is based on my book. I guess he didn't bother to mention that. But I guess the bottom line is it's very simple to delineate. Greenspan's made plenty of mistakes. And those are certainly recounted in my book in fairly great detail. But I think people would have a hard time arguing that Greenspan hasn't also had a once he's actually been as a private economist, he made some mistakes, including writing a letter in support of a savings and loan that failed. But in the real prime time, in the spotlight as Fed chairman, he's overseen and been a partial architect or helped with the longest boom in U.S. economic history. And I think that would be hard to take away from him. So I guess the bottom line is he's made some mistakes. They're certainly recounted in my book and other good books as well. But then his term as Fed chairman has been pretty impressive, hard to argue with. Certainly some mistakes there, too, which I get into. But that's the bottom line.
We are a little bit past here our midpoint, and I think probably I should introduce again our guest, and we'll get right back to the phones because we have a number of callers. We're talking this morning with Justin Martin. He's a former staff writer at Fortune magazine. His work has appeared in other publications, too, including Newsweek and Worth. And he's the author of a newly published biography of Alan Greenspan, the head of the Federal Reserve. The title of his book is Greenspan, The Man Behind the Money, published by Perseus. So if you're interested, you can head out to the store and take a look at it. And the questions are welcome. We'll try to get as many as we can. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to have somebody here on a cell phone, line number four. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'd like to, I guess, join the chorus of people out here in the Midwest who question Greenspan's role. A lot of the information is very, very interesting, and I'm enjoying this, but I'd like to question the amount of credit he gets for the economy of the last 8 years. Republicans would like to give him the bulk of the credit and ignore the Clinton economic plan that was implemented in 93. But if you look at specifically, when you get beyond Greenspan's famous obfuscations, and look specifically at some of the predictions he made, when the unemployment rate was creeping down towards 6%, he started ratcheting up interest rates, saying that unemployment below 6% would be inflationary. We've now had about 4 years of unemployment between 3% and 4%. And if you look at the specific prediction he made, which was sort of an article of faith among mainstream economists, he was simply wrong. And what he did was, I think, take a lot of money out of the pockets of working people by jawboning down wages unnecessarily. Seems to me like, in retrospect, economic historians will say that these were great years, but there are people who say that the economy sort of goes in cycles. And no one's efforts would have corrected the economy of the 70s. I mean, it was just sort of doomed to head into what happened in the 80s. And likewise, in retrospect, there's a constellation of a whole bunch of factors came together to make the 90s a good time. And Greenspan and no one else deserves any particular credit. These things just happened.
Well, it's an excellent question. Again, let's go to our guest. And Mr. Martin, what do you think?
I think it is an excellent question and an excellent point. I would say that the caller is certainly right when he says a constellation of factors played a role here. Everything from the fall of the Berlin Wall, which led to a situation which the United States could expend a lot more effort on the economy versus national defense, the technological revolution, the Internet, which was the great engines of wealth creation, NAFTA, which was something that was dreamed up by George Bush and shepherded through by Bill Clinton, on and on and on, just any number of different factors that have led to this. But I also think that it's important to give Greenspan credit where credit is due. And where he deserves credit is for being very flexible. As new rules have started to, or as the old rules have been broken, he's been quick to make adjustments and make changes. The caller made reference to the fact that the unemployment rate began to fall beneath a level at which it traditionally would signal that the economy was tightening and the economy might overheat. And Greenspan has taken that data and sort of broken the old model. So I thought, okay, unemployment can be much lower than we previously thought because we have a more productive economy. So he's been very flexible, and it's very well worth pointing out that you have several events. The crash of 1987, a period in the early 1990s when Clinton just came into the office when the economy was sluggish, and the so-called Asian contagion, 1998. Any of these times could have been real forks in the road. The crash of 87, had Greenspan and the Fed not respond properly, we could have had a deep recession. In the early 1990s when the economy was sluggish, had the Fed not done really savvy interest rate policy, the economy may have continued to be sluggish. In 1998, when the Asian contagion began to threaten our shores, when problems in Korea and Russia looked like they might spill over into the United States, had Greenspan not done very, very savvy calibration of interest rates at the right time and the right way and backed it up in public pronouncements with words, we might have again had an economic dislocation, perhaps a recession. So I think that the caller is absolutely right in saying there are a whole confluence of factors, and certainly Greenspan's been the beneficiary of some great historical movements and business cycle fluctuations that don't have anything to do with him. But he's certainly bolstered this economic expansion every way he can with savvy monetary policy at some critical junctures.
I really appreciate the question of the caller. I hope you'll forgive me for wanting to go on. We have just about 10 minutes and three other callers, and we'll try to get in at all the people that we can. Going next to a caller here on line number two, and that is Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Number two is in Urbana.
Yes.
Great show. Very interesting, even for those of us who are not economists. I do have a slight question, though, and that is Mr. Greenspan has colleagues, and I don't even know what to call them. They are so much in the background. Are they commissioners? Are they committee members? How does one even refer to them?
Great question. Well, he's surrounded by 11 other governors. That's the term for them, and
uh-huh.
A giant, giant retinue of economists. The Fed employs so many professional economists. I think it's more than almost any other institution in the world, more than Harvard University or Stanford. So he's got the governors who he's working with directly, sort of on a board, and then a number of economists supporting the research efforts of the Fed and policy directives.
Thank you.
All
right. Thank you for the call. And then I guess let me have to bring my chat page back up here again. Next caller, I think this is also Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, a long time ago I read tried to read a couple of articles that he wrote for a book called Capitalism, which Ayn Rand apparently edited, and it really I don't think I could get through him because it just curled my hair. He's such a laissez-faire, you know, gung-ho, the overclass, let's form a pirate ship and go out and conquer kind of point of view. Like the caller before last, my big thing with Greenspan is that is exactly what he brought up whenever he claims to be talking about a heated up economy. What he's really talking about is that wages and salaries go up, and you know, he's got this kind of he's always going toward always trying to benefit the wealthy at the expense of working people. And I was just wondering if you think if really confronted on that one issue, which he's never been as far as I can tell, if you think he might have a some sort of cogent response to that, or would he just, like you say, obfuscate?
Are you asking if he was confronted on the issue of whether he really ultimately supports the interest of the wealthy? Is that the question?
Over at the expense of what I would assume he considers the underclass, or the overclass over the underclass.
Sure. Well, good question. I'll say, first of all, I think if he was confronted directly with that question, I think if history is any guide, I think he would be likely to obfuscate. I think he would give a long and circular answer. But not to speak for him, but I will attempt to, you know, at least answer the broader question if that's what his policies in fact support. And I would really come down the side of no, they're not actually. The Federal Reserve, people rightly point out that the Federal Reserve worries about unemployment getting too low, and what a perverse thing that seems to be. I mean, why should unemployment just go down to zero? That would be wonderful. That would be perfect. But in fact, one thing that's very interesting about the capitalist economy that we have is that it's set up in such a way there has to be some fluidity. It has to be possible for people to migrate from jobs that they're not well suited to jobs where they're better suited. There has to be a lot more flexibility than in a state-controlled economy, such as the Soviet Union had for many years. And in such an economy, you've got to have part of that dynamism of a high-tech economy particularly. You've got to have some level of unemployment to have people moving around, moving from job to job, finding a job where they fit. The other thing is, if you have really, really low unemployment, this is incontrovertible. What starts to happen, now nobody knows what the exact level is, and that's where Greenspan's been very flexible. Is it 6%? Is it 4%? Is it 3% unemployment? But one thing that's incontrovertible is that what starts to happen is when you have very low unemployment, employers become desperate for employees. What they in turn start doing is bidding up the price for employees. When they bid up those prices and pay employees higher salaries, they then have to raise the price on their goods and services. That leads to inflation. Consumers wind up buying less goods and services. That causes the businesses to slow down. And wait a minute, all of a sudden, this very low unemployment has led to a bad situation where we're actually sliding into a recession, and that low unemployment leads to much higher unemployment. And so ultimately, the Fed is trying to seek a balance. As so many things in the world are an aim to achieve a balance, the Fed's actually trying to achieve a balance by trying to keep unemployment sustainable, not too high, obviously, and not too low. And if it's allowed to go too low, it'll bounce back ultimately and come too high. So I think that's something people often don't understand about the workings of the Fed.
Oh, I understand it perfectly, but you just made my point, because what you were saying essentially is that the workers got to take a hit once in a while, but the capitalists are allowed to always increase their prices to cover their profits.
That's
essentially what you said. I think it's ludicrous. Thank you.
Oh, sure.
All right. Well, we'll get one more caller here in Champaign. It's line number 3. Hello.
Yes. Continuing from the last point. So we have a theory called the non-accelerating inflationary rate of unemployment, which says that if unemployment goes below a certain level, there's a theory, okay, and supposedly we need to plug a number into that theory. It used to be 6%. Now it's 4%. Maybe it's 2%. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like if my kid went to school and they told them, well, today pi is 3.14, but tomorrow it's going to be 4, and the next day after that it might be 2.3. This theory is ludicrous, okay? Robert Eisner, in a very good book called The Real Economy, points out, I think argues very well. He was former president of the American Economic Association and unfortunately died several years ago. But in this book, The Real Economy, he makes absolute mincemeat of this theory. This is simply a theory used by capitalists and by the privileged to dictate that the unemployment rate should not go below a certain point, so that people's wages will not be lifted. It is simply assumed that it is more important for stock owners and very wealthy people to make profits than it is for people at the lowest levels of the economy to get a raise in wages. This business of people moving from job to job, I don't know where you got that. That has nothing to do with anything. People will do that whatever the labor market is, especially if wages are going up. So that has nothing to do with it. And in regard to the previous unfortunate comments about Jews, which were totally inappropriate, and you say the Fed chairman comes from diverse backgrounds. My question, have any of them not been a white male? Have any of them not been privileged? Have any of them had viewpoints that disagreed with corporate leaders and banking leaders in this country?
Sure, I'll take both. The first point being, has a Fed chairman, have we yet had a Fed chairman that's other than a white male? I'll say, unfortunately, no, we have not. However, the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve right now, the possible heir apparent, is a man named Roger Ferguson, who is an African-American. There have been very high-ranking and continue to be high-ranking females on the board of the Federal Reserve. And just as, unfortunately, we haven't had a president or many other roles in the United States occupied to this point by someone other than a white male, it seems like those doors are getting knocked down.
And on what basis did you state that federal chairmen have come from diverse backgrounds?
At that point, I simply meant diverse from the standpoint they had not just been Jews, they've been Mormons and other. But
they
haven't been
so
diverse.
We've had all kinds of privileged white males wearing blue suits in this job.
So far it's been occupied by, but yes, it has been occupied by white males of somewhat diverse backgrounds, and you know, the Fed has responded to challenges about diversity by, as I said, the second command of the Fed right now is an African-American man named Roger Ferguson, and there are a variety of others. I could not possibly even hope or try to defend the lack of diversity at the Fed or any other institution, but I would say that there are strides being made.
We're at the time that we're pretty much going to have to stop. I don't know if there was any last thought that you or last point that you wanted to make before we end up having to wrap up.
I guess the only last point I'd want to make is several callers in a row sort of raised the point that they sort of muddy the waters to a degree by talking about the non-inflationary theories of unemployment, which is actually a theory first proposed by Milton Friedman, so it's hardly Greenspan's theory. And Greenspan, I think, lost in all this is Greenspan's been extremely flexible. He hasn't ascribed in any way to this particular theory. It was the theory held that if unemployment fell below 6%, you would have inflation. And Greenspan has been very comfortable watching unemployment fall below 6, below 5, below 4. And the ultimate thing is that the Fed actually reads the tea leaves, looks at the economy, and looks for signs of a slowing economy, signs of inflation creeping up. And if it doesn't see those, it's certainly not going to. I mean, if unemployment can get down to zero without causing instability and imbalances in the economy, which it almost certainly would, but if that could happen, the Fed wouldn't touch things. So the notion that Greenspan is somehow an advocate of unemployment shows a confusion about the Fed's role.
Well, we're going to have to stop with the promise that perhaps on another day we'll get back to some of these issues. But for the moment, we want to say, Mr. Martin, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
And thanks for being so flexible with us this morning.
Oh, sure. Happy to be. Thank you very much.
Our guest, Justin Martin, former staff writer at Fortune magazine. If you'd like to read the book, it's titled Greenspan, The Man Behind Money, or The Man Behind Money. Perseus Publishing is the publisher.